Okay. So do I have a motion to approve the minutes of March 9th?
So moved.
Second? Any changes? We're good? Okay, all in favor?
Aye.
Motion approved. Okay, Cornell.
Hi, everybody. I'm going to be relatively brief on my end because I had the opportunity to speak to a lot of you last month, which I very much appreciate it. And I'm pinch hitting a bit for my colleague in Healthy Communities, which is on vacation, which we all get to do at some point. So hopefully your questions aren't too rigorous around Healthy Communities, but I certainly can speak to some of the different programs that we're running. So I'm just doing kind of a real overview of some of our programs that I wanted to talk through with you. So for 4-H youth development, we have our Community Club program, which reaches about 400 youth, more or less, every year. We do a number of after-school programs. Some of these are, actually most of these are grant-funded or fee-for-service. The Tech Wizards program is a mentoring program. We actually receive funding through the Office of Juvenile Justice and Delinquency Prevention, federal agency, to run this mentoring program that targets youth who are often underrepresented in STEM careers. So by that, we mean girls, Black and Latino youth, and other people who consider to be underserved or underrepresented. And we match them with local youth-friendly professionals who do a number of different projects for them. This was actually a Tech Wizards program, so we got to go to SUNY New Paltz and play around in their 3D printing lab at their advanced manufacturing center, and they were looking at some of these iPhone-printed cases and got to do kind of their own computer-added design and all kinds of fun stuff. We are currently, actually last year we served 90 youth, so we were way over-enrolled. We actually had to cut down a little bit. We don't have that many resources to serve that many youth, so this year we will just be serving the 60 youth. In Kingston here, we participate in the TOPS, Teachers, Organizations, Parents, and Students After School Program. This was sort of modeled off of 21st century funding, and twice a week we go to George Washington Elementary and do a number of different programs with them there. A lot of our programs were nutrition-based. We did a lot of cooking, healthy living and cooking programs. And we also did very science-oriented programs this year to connect them to the Hudson River and to the watershed. So some great projects that we did with them. We're currently running a bicycle safety program. How many of you guys have ever seen a not-safe bicyclist? I'm a bicyclist, so don't get really crazy. So I'm both a driver and a cyclist, but you know, there are a lot of unsafe cyclists there, and there are a lot of unsafe drivers out there. So we're working with middle school age boys and girls, actually, at the Hodge. That's really the target community because those are the youth who are least likely to really be wearing their helmets and most likely to sustain traumatic brain injury if they do fall. So we're working with about 20 youth to safely bike across Kingston while aligned with many of the initiatives that are going on within Kingston and within Ulster County. Some other special interest programs that we run just on Saturday, we were at SUNY Ulster. Thank you very much. We ran a great program. Meg was wonderful. I just met her, the events coordinator over there. And we had about 90 youth from seven different 4-H counties, that were recommended to progress on to a district level of public presentations. I definitely met a 9-year-old who was smarter than I'll ever be. I'll just tell you that right now. She was presenting about gene coding and CRISPR something, and gave a 5-minute presentation that I was like, okay, wow. I could barely follow that in U9. Her 13-year-old sister, I believe, just graduated from SUNY Ulster, so clearly very, very bright family. But this is a venue where we give them, teach them their public speaking skills, and they get constructive feedback about how they can improve their public speaking skills. A select number will go on to state 4-H public presentation. Ag literacy this year, we reached the highest number that I have ever presided over, and I believe our highest number in Ulster County for sure. 960 youth were reached during Ag Literacy Week. Quite impressive. In almost every single school district that we have in Ulster County, we coordinated that between probably about 15 volunteers. Congressman Gibson actually came and read at Edson, which was great. 100 second graders, that was lovely. And Mary Beth Mayo actually also read in her district, so we really appreciated that. Wonderful program, reached so many kids, great way to connect them to 4-H. Vet Science, we have a long-standing history with SUNY Ulster of connecting them to the Vet Tech program there. We really run that program with Dr. Beth Alden, who is an amazing ally and really has brought together some amazing speakers for our kids. Like I said, we always see our kids end up in SUNY Ulster, and I do want to believe that some of that is due to the connection we make through these Best Science programs. So we generally serve about 30 youth a year for our vet science, intro to vet science program, hands-on, 8 weeks, great program. And tractor safety, where we actually certify youth and make sure that they can safely drive a tractor and they're not going to hurt themselves. We have a volunteer who's been doing it for quite some time. He was a national award winner in 4-H. I think he came in maybe second place nationally for knowing how to safely drive a tractor. So we really have one of the best right here in our county who that runs this program for our youth to make sure they are safely driving.
How old are the tractor drivers?
They can be 13 and 19, and they can only get certified at 14, I believe. But we can do 13, 19. We almost always have adult participants as well, which we do let come in and audit the class, as we have sort of this burgeoning young farmer initiatives. I feel like we do get to see, we do have adults who are also interested in tractor safety, and we're always happy to accommodate them when we have room for them to audit our classes. Those are kind of still happening right now. For Healthy Communities, our three main programs right now, we have Creating Healthy Places, which did so much to help infrastructure within many communities within Ulster County. And that just sunset last year, and we're transitioned into a number of different initiatives that we have. I feel like Live Well Houston has definitely helped to kind of keep that torch lit and do some great programming. So the other programs within Healthy Communities are the Relatives as Parents program, funded mainly through Dyson. I will say almost all of our Healthy Communities programs are grant-funded programs, so we've been able to sustain them through grant funding. The downside of that always being, of course, that those grants do sunset, and we haven't found an additional source yet. We have to find a way to transition them to other places or find ways to have continuation of programming. We also do nutrition education, including food preservation classes and service days. Sometimes it smells awesome in here when you walk in, and sometimes Jane is doing some great sourdough classes or teaching people how to preserve and do canning. We get to see those a lot. Those are usually a fee-based service as well. And then with the service days every month, we run a food safety, food manager safety course to make sure that people are practicing good, safe food practices, which really do impact us all. And Live Well Kingston, which has been, so Live Well Kingston was kind of born after the Robert Wood Johnson grant that we received by Healthy Kingston for Kids. Sort of sunset in the past years, we were able to transition that into a coalition where we got multiple partners to sign in on, including healthcare agencies, City of Kingston, and really we're kind of transitioning that program more to the City of Kingston. It really does have direct benefit, and we are seeing that that program will keep going as the years go on. We think it's a great program, and creating all kinds of, again, different infrastructure and other changes that are helping Kingston to be a safer place to, I think it's walk, go, ride, or something like that. So all kinds of great stuff happening there. Let's see. So benefits to Ulster County residents of our programs, both of them, are really have college and career-ready youth who can, and the numbers you'll see are the kids who actually self-reported that this was a skill they learned last year directly through 4-H programming. So we have college and career-ready youth who can solve problems. 101 youth reported that, stay motivated, know how to motivate themselves to get things done, and be responsible. 79 youth said that as well. Connect locally and globally. So this is actually a picture of in Ulster County, we were able to restart the global exchange program that is run through an organization called States 4-H. We ran it successfully for 2 years where we connected Japanese exchange students with Ulster County and other local residents. We are now transitioning that to the state because it's really better run through New York State, but we were really instrumental in getting that program back on track, getting it running again, making sure that our kids are having that global experience. A lot of times our kids really only live in their small little communities, and there's so much more for them to explore, be exposed to, et cetera. The Japanese exchange program was a great way to do that. These were our kids from last summer. We're also, some of the other benefits are we're engaged in Ulster County key initiatives, including tech and healthy living. We've really been connecting to a lot of the agencies that are doing some amazing work in these areas. The county appropriation really allows us to run the youth portion of the Ulster County Fair. I know you guys like your milkshakes. I like my milkshakes, too. And we like all of the animal science skills that youth learn. Again, they're also part of creating a healthy ecosystem around food, a healthy system where kids know what are the biohazards of around food, how do we raise a healthy animal. So all of this stuff, I really feel like we're the only youth development agency that's doing that in this county. Agricultural literacy program, as I said, the 4-H club program, and the public speaking programs, we're able to do all of those programs due to the money we received for the county appropriation of 4-H. I passed this out last month when I saw most of you guys. If anybody did not get a copy of it, I just did an economic impact study of what Ulster County 4-H, the economic impact that we have on the county, what we, for the money that we receive, what's the real value of what we bring. So I'll pass these around. If anybody didn't get one last time or you just want an extra copy, they're all yours. Again, for a 4-H budget from the county appropriation of $77,000, the real value is somewhere in the area of $323,000 value of the county. We're really volunteer run, so very valuable. And lastly, opportunities and challenges within both 4-H and healthy communities. Opportunities, we see a lot of opportunities in connecting and training residents and initiatives that meet community needs. Technology, healthy living, workforce development, there's been a lot of great stuff that I've been hearing about at State of the County, Patterns for Progress, all the different conversations we've been having around trends in Ulster County. We went recently to the Hudson Valley Tech Meetup. Have you guys been? Has it been unbelievable, the things that are happening? Over 1,000 members of this meetup group in Kingston. I think there were almost 200 attendees that night. I had one of my colleagues present about the Tech Wizards program and trying to get more mentors for that program. But it's incredible to see how much is happening in our small community around tech and healthy living and workforce development as well. So we're looking to connect to all those different initiatives. We're also looking to create cross-county economies of scale across programs. So right now I'm currently the 4-H leader in Ulster County as well as in Dutchess County and Sullivan, who are purchasing some of my services. It's been a hectic time juggling the three counties, but it's given me an awesome kind of bird's eye view of what are some of the programs that we're not doing very smart. What are the programs that we can regionalize? What are the programs we can do better if we create these different economies of scale? So I am seeing a lot of opportunities there. I'll be working with executive directors and 4-H leaders from, I think it's about 7 different counties on April 20th, 6 force of those. State force programming is a big one that we're going to be looking at. And some of our challenges are finding additional opportunities to fund the 4-H Flood Program. Like I said, it's such an amazing program. It's a program that people really bleed green. They really put their hearts and souls into. It is a program that's been around for 100 years that we want to continue building on. But it's not a program that's really viable for grant funding in many different ways. People are hard pressed to find a way to make a program that's been around for 100 years something into a grant-funded opportunity, and we run through volunteers, so it's also hard to say, okay, I just got money, now you guys have to do X, Y, and Z. These are volunteers who are doing this because they love it, they're doing it because their interests are in certain areas, and because they want kids to be able to self-determine some of the different project areas that they're in. So that continues to be a challenge, although one we are finding ways to meet. And also expanding Ulster County core funding to create continuity between funding opportunities. Like I said, we have so much talent within our program, and we really have been pretty aggressively looking for grants that make sense, that are within our mission, and that are really bringing amazing opportunities to Ulster County residents. We continue to do that, and we want to find a way to shore up that base to make sure that we don't lose our talent and don't lose our staff when grant opportunities are between for a couple months. So you guys have any questions?
It says that the 77,000 turns into that.
Yeah.
Where do you come up with that?
Sure. We have a hard budget of about $150,000. That includes the grant funding and other things that we're able to do because we have that base. On top of that, I calculate the number of volunteers we have and the kind of standard volunteer rate per hour and roughly calculate how much time they're putting into that. So we usually have about 100 volunteers. I don't remember the exact average that I was using, but the kind of recognized volunteer hour average times the number of hours on average that each 4-H volunteer is spending per month. And that's
do you have a breakdown of that you could
share? I do. I would be happy to send it along to you.
Thank you.
What's the best way to get it to you?
Email.
Perfect. We'll do. Happy to send it along.
The 77 gets you to leverage another 77, shall we say, from outside. Is that correct?
The 77 is what the part of the 300.
Right, that's part of the
right.
As well.
Right. So we get 77 of that, and that absolutely helps us to leverage other grants. And so, we're flexible people. So instead of being able to do both a club program and a Tech Wizards mentoring program, and not having to hire a staff on additionally, and then you have to deal with all the things of hiring and letting go staff, depending on a grant funded opportunity, we're able to sort of. I've been really trying to get our program almost. That each one of us is about half on county dollars so that we can put in the time that we really need to be putting in to the county program and half on other funding structures, whether that's grant funded, fee for service, what have you. We did this year also, I will say, this year we did start implementing club enrollment fees. Most of the counties around us charge close to $25, $50 per kid to be enrolled in 4-H. We never used to charge anything. We now charge, just I started messaging about 2 years ago, this year we started implementing a $100 club fee. We really encourage clubs to do that fundraising so that they aren't charging the kids themselves. And we also let clubs be as big as they would like to be. So part of the, we're trying to kind of get away from this model of these five-person clubs that are just one person and their family, you know, two adults and it's their kids. And then 4-H clubs are meant to be sustainable over time. We do have clubs that have been around for 50 years, I believe. So they're really, when we charter a new club, it's supposed to be sustainable over time. You can't do that when you have two families who are just in 4-H with their own kids. So we really have been encouraging people to move on to finding community centers, finding places where people can really, from the community, can meet and be involved in 4-H, and making these clubs bigger and more sustainable. Our most sustainable clubs have 50 kids and 6 trained leaders in them. So we've really been moving people to that model. We felt like that fee structure would help kind of get some of these smaller clubs to join up with other clubs and start being a little bit more sustainable over time.
I could ask you the question, but if you don't, I'm not sure if you can answer, but I know Lee can.
Sure.
What are the total number of employees that you have?
About 30, I would say.
Between 30 and 35, depending on. We do a lot with interns and folks that come and go.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. 3 different offices.
For 4-H, we have...
They're basically sustained through the county donation along with grants to do leverage because of the county.
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
Yep.
Absolutely.
So just to make it clear, then that $300,000, a little bit over $300,000, keeps 36 employees.
Absolutely.
We have about 500.
And that doesn't count the services.
Absolutely. Right.
We have about $500 million budget. So we've been able to take, and we've been able to parlay the county dollars, which is critical to our being here and whatever, into a lot of things.
Mm-hmm. Any other questions? Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
If it's okay with everyone, before we have our next presentation, we thought we'd have a pizza break since it's here and it's hot.
How about we'll just we'll let the college speak first.
Sure.
So that you can. You're welcome.
We may want pizza too.
Well, he didn't stay for pizza.
He can stay for pizza.
I appreciate that.
Do you want to come up here, or do you want to come here?
Short and brief, because we have no money, so that's not a long conversation.
You're going to tell us how the state budget affected
the state. We asked for 285 increase per FTE, and they gave us 100. So it's the net gain to us with the decrease we anticipate in enrollment is we'll actually have a lower budget this year than we had the previous year. So we have taken the initiative because we anticipated $100. We were hoping for the best, but we planned for the worst. So for the last 3 months, we've been taking every department of the entire institution and going line by line, justifying, looking at ways to economize, looking at ways to move folks, to maybe reduce some programs. There are some programs that are growing. So we do have some initiatives, that, especially with the Kingston Center. We plan on doing some major new programs down at Human Services. We're working with ARC. We have about 800 employees that they have. They're all looking for training. So we anticipate doing a lot of training with them. So although we expect about 6% decrease in enrollment for next year based on the enrollments of the high schools, it's natural. We hope that to level off the following year. So it might be our worst year that we have to accommodate some of these adjustments. So right now we're looking at about a 5% decrease in total budget. So we've been doing that for 3 months. So we don't have any exact runs right now. We were waiting to find out what we were going to get from the state. So within the next 3 or 4 weeks, we will have a proposed budget. We're actually going to have three case scenarios that we'll bring that forward to you.
Now, is all that going to affect your fund balance?
Our fund balance starting September was $500,000, and right now we've spent probably $200,000 of it. So we may have to dig into that.
But we have put more or less a freeze on all spending as of January. We've scrutinized every penny that's come through. We've lived fine through it, but we should be able to surplus some of those dollars to build that up. So we're going to be using for some of that. Plus, we have some very basic things that we're going to have to invest on. That's electronics. That's our computer systems. So we're trying to squirrel away some money so we can keep those 70-year-old computers, bring them up somewhat so that kids really have the equipment they need, to, especially in those areas. Technology is the most expensive. So more to come in the next month. This is where we're really going to sit down and work with our board to see what their recommendations are. And we'll bring that to you, bring it forward, yeah. So that's where we stand right now. A lot of work being done, absolutely.
Thank you. Does anybody have any questions? No. Thank you.
Well, I appreciate the support. I know the resolution for 285 was, it was good to see that the support of that. So anyway, we'll keep our fingers crossed and we'll hope for the best. Thanks. More to come.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Because we'll take a big break.
Man, I'll always take a pizza break.
I see my slice to the legislator with the baseball cap. Oh, the football cap.
But you can.
You want a slice of pizza, Steve? Yeah. Yep.
I'm going to see a presentation here.
Yeah.
So, I'm Leslie Zucker. I'm the Issues Leader for Environment and Natural Resources, I'm going to talk to you today about probably our primary environment program, which is the Ashokan Watershed Stream Management Program. We're focused through this program on education extension on stream and watershed management in one particular area of the county, but we also do some countywide programming in invasive species and forestry in collaboration with our agriculture program. So this program is fairly self-sufficient. It has $6.3 million in funding over 5 years, but it wouldn't be possible without the CCE and the county funding that you provide. So you're really leveraging that $6.3 million and everything that I'm about to show you. So I just want to show you a little bit about what we did in 2015 so you get to know a program a little bit better. The mission of the stream program is to work in partnership with the communities to protect and restore stream corridor stability and ecosystem integrity in the Ashokan watershed. So it gives you a sense that we are very science-oriented and we're extending science and engineering to applying it to stream management in our watershed. Cooperative Extension is in partnership with the Ulster County Soil and Water Conservation District and the New York City Department of Environmental Protection to run this program. DEP is our primary funder. That's where that $6.3 million over 5 years comes from. And the program, the Ashokan Stream Program, really started back in 2003, 2004. Extension has been a key partner in this program then for over a decade, since 2004 when we were conducting stakeholder surveys and developing the Osopus Creek, Upper Osopus Creek Stream Management Plan. So the watershed, as you probably know, is in northwest Ulster County. We primarily work with the towns of Woodstock, Hurley, Olive, and Shandaken in Ulster County. Ulster County participates in our stakeholder council and our working groups, and we're funding projects for the county as well. And the Ashokan Reservoir Watershed, you know, this is part of the New York City drinking water supply, and it's fed by the Upper Osopus Creek, which starts up here in Olivaria, circles around Slide Mountain, and then drains down through Phoenicia, Boysville, major hamlets in the watershed, into the reservoir. We have four CCE staff that are working for the stream program, myself, the program leader, watershed educator Brent Goach, and a part-time watershed youth educator, Matt Savacki, our administrative assistant, Jamie Joy. We also really, there's a lot of administration and coordination and management that we do, so we rely heavily on the staff here in Kingston as well. And then since 2014, we've entered into a collaboration with the Ulster County Department of Environment to bring a full-time environmental planner out to the watershed to work on flood hazard mitigation with our communities, and that's Aaron Bennett, who's also grew up in the watershed. So one of CC's primary responsibilities is to coordinate and organize stakeholder input into the STREAM program. We held 30 stakeholder meetings in 2015 alone, and these are just a few of the organizations that are involved, but there are more. So the stakeholder council and all of our working groups. And now I have like a little bit of a slideshow with a little, you know, little wrap I do. So we hold a number of educational events and trainings typically throughout the year. And I'm just going to breeze through with a bunch of pictures of some of them so you can get a sense of what we do. In 2015, we held our annual Ashokan Watershed Conference at the Ashokan Center, which had 92 attendees. The conference featured presentations on local history, the past and future of stream management, talks about invasive species, and a stream expert panel. Typically, we get 100 to 150 people, very popular within the watershed. And currently, we're planning a biannual science conference that CC is heavily involved in, called the Catskill Environmental Research and Monitoring Conference, and that'll be October 27th to 28th in the Bethesda Mountain Ski Center. Through community events, we provided education on stream macroinvertebrates and water quality to 670 school-aged children, and we directly reached an additional 1,452 youth and adults with information about stream management. We indirectly reached over 12,000 people through web postings and mailings and another 16,000 through social media. Community events we organized or participated in included the Phoenicia, Woodstock, and Bennett School Earth Days, Little Beaverkill and Rochester Hollow Stream Walks, Family Fun and Fish Day at the Kenneth Wilson State Campground, Ulster County Fair, Shandaken Day, Olive Day, and a Riparian Pollinators Program. Stream program staff also visit throughout the community municipal officials, consultants, regulators, and landowners, and we do trainings for our own staff. In 2015, CCE contracted with consulting firm Tetra Tech to deliver a one-day training on FEMA's community rating system, which is a program communities can enter to lower flood insurance premiums through NIFIP. That was attended by 20 town officials and consultants, and we're going to continue to give these professional-level trainings in support of stream and floodplain management in 2016. Since 2013, our watershed educator, oops, I got some youth education in here. All right, so in 2015, with a small grant from the Catskill Watershed Corporation, we expanded our youth education program. Our youth educator, Matt Savacki, brought in-school enrichment programs to the Bennett, Woodstock, and Phoenicia elementary schools in the Ontario School District. Another highlight of the year, in May, one of our stakeholder groups, our Stream Access and Recreation Working Group, held a special meeting with DEP to discuss their plans to install a lower-level outlet at the Schoharie Reservoir. And the outlet is to allow water releases to the lower Schoharie Creek, which they've been diverting all of the water from the Schoharie Reservoir through a tunnel down to the Sophus Creek into the Ashokan Reservoir. Except for spillover. Our Sophus Creek stakeholders, though, were concerned that the coldest water in the reservoir would be depleted through release to the lower Schoharie Creek, threatening the Sophus Creek fishery. So after a discussion of the release, this is the portal right here into the Sophus Creek, and after a discussion with senior level DEP staff over their release strategy, DEP agreed to investigate possible alternative designs that would maintain the Sophus Creek fishery. This is a sort of collaboration and discussion that wouldn't happen without this program, and instead might end up with another lawsuit and the loss of the fishery. So I'm very happy to be a part of something like that. Okay, so throughout 2015, CCE staff participated in all town flood advisory committee meetings. That was 6 in the town of Shandaken and 5 in Olive. And we also assisted watershed residents throughout the year with reading and interpreting new flood maps and other floodplain topics. As part of our technical assistance that we provide, Aaron Bennett held 27 meetings with county and town officials to identify and record watershed flood mitigation projects. And these projects were included in the updated Ulster County Multi-Jurisdictional Hazard Mitigation Plan, qualifying the communities for FEMA funding if there's another disaster declared. So I just had two more of our many projects that I wanted to mention that I thought you particular Ulster County might be interested in. CCE manages and administers a $3 million funding program that's focused on assisting the county, towns, and nonprofits in the watershed with implementing stream management plan recommendations. So this is kind of a typical amount of grant projects that we're running at one time. We have 10 awarded projects running right now. They total about $766,000, and $128,000 of that is going to the Ulster County DPW for stream-related infrastructure improvements. So right here, a culvert replacement on Lion Hollow in the town of Olive, and a slope stabilization along Peekamoose Road that's where the stream is eroding into the road, creating unsafe conditions. So that program is ongoing. We've already spent over $2 million to this program in the previous 5 years, assisting the community. The second project I wanted you to know about is where there's a major new flood hazard mitigation effort in the watershed. So as you know, the Catskills have received, in particular the Catskills in Ulster County, have been having larger storms. We've had quite a few large storms over the last 15 years. And the trend line, this is the trend graph showing, this trend line right here is the increasing frequency of large storms. It's a Coldbrook stream gauge on the upper Sopus Creek from 1931 through now. So we, you know, assuming these might continue, we're helping the communities prepare for them. And after Tropical Storm Irene, the counties went to New York City and requested that they spend more of their stream management program funding assisting the communities with identifying and implementing flood hazard solutions, flood hazard reduction solutions. So this led to a fairly unprecedented effort to analyze the causes of flooding and carry out hydraulic modeling, computer modeling, an analysis to identify solutions that are both cost-effective and feasible. And I just wanted to show you, we have some results for the hamlet of Phoenicia. The town of Shandaken hired the consulting firm Malone and McBroom to run this project, and there's a long public engagement process where the town flood advisory committee, members of the public, identify ideas for how to reduce the flood levels and the extent of flooding in the hamlets of Phoenicia and Mount Tremper. And the report is now done, and this is a project that is one of the more cost-effective and hopefully feasible. This is Phoenicia. The project involves excavating down this existing floodplain area, and the area shaded in pink would be lowered about 3 to 4 feet to create more water storage capacity in the center of the hamlet. The project also involves replacing the Bridge Street Bridge. This is Main Street right here. This is the Stony Clove Creek draining into the Esopus Creek and heading downstream. Water flows out of the Stony Clove down Main Street and into the Esopus down here. And the pictures that I just showed you are of this bridge right here, County Bridge, Bridge Street Bridge, during Tropical Storm Irene. This is the bridge right here, underwater in the Esopus Creek. And this is right after the water receded, what it looked like. It actually shifted the bridge. The center line was off by, I think, something like a foot. And they put it back, but it's in bad shape. Right now, it's in bad shape. So this solution would involve replacing and expanding the Bridge Street Bridge, probably making this road defunct and putting the new intersection in here. There are some buyouts and relocations of structures down in here that would be required. Now, these are structures that saw 8 feet of water or more during Tropical Storm Irene, so we think these landowners are going to be interested. It would be voluntary buyout and relocation. So this is the kind of solution we're looking at. This is a $10 million project. The floodplain restoration itself is 1.7 to replace the bridge. The engineers estimated around 5 million. And what it gets you, this is a flood depth grid showing Phoenicia, and there's about up to a 1.2 foot reduction over here, the Main Street Business District, during a flood the size of Tropical Storm Irene, and in other places there are reductions. There's no silver bullet. There's no way to prevent flooding in these population centers in the Catskills. There's steep mountain valleys. The water's rushing down fast. And we can't completely eliminate flooding, but there are ways to mitigate the impacts. And at the more higher the storms that occur more frequently, can really reduce damages when you can pull more water off of, you know, like Main Street in this case. So this is going on all over the New York City watershed, and we're also running this analysis in Boyceville and Washoe in the town of Olive. I'm trying to give you a flavor of the type of work that we're doing through this program. So that's what I got. Yes.
In an earlier flood, I think it was before Irene, and I think it was 2010 or even summer of fall of 2009. Remember that the debate was also about the Stony Clove because it was not Stony Clove because really the under the bridge it was really filling up. It used to be 10 feet deep, then it was up to 2 or 4 feet deep, and that really had a lot to do with stream bank stabilization and the creek just continuously filling up. Mm-hmm. So what's to prevent that from continuing?
That's actually the first real flood site of the first real flood mitigation project that went in the town of Shandaken. So that site was treated. It did fill up to within, something like 3 feet at the bottom of the bridge over the Stony Clove during Irene. There was a project in the works, actually, that Liz had started on before Irene. And what they did was they engineered the channel to try to they dug it out, they removed the sediment, and they put in structures in the channel that are meant to increase the velocity of the flow, steepen the channel slightly there, and move sediment under that bridge. And the Soil and Water District, so it was built, and the Soil and Water District has been monitoring it. The only reason DC gave a permit is it was a little bit experimental, and they don't usually give permits for digging out streams, but they wanted to see if we could apply these engineering techniques and it would work if we could get sediment under that bridge and we quit filling in under the bridge. The Soil and Water District has been monitoring it, and we've had now, I think, only one bank forming flow, one flow where a lot of sediment was moving, and so far it's performing. What would happen in a stream, in a flood the size of Irene again, we don't know. It may fill up there again. But at least at the types of floods that return every 2 years, every 3 years, maybe even higher, maybe we're hoping up to a 10-year return frequency flood, that stream engineering right there will continue to perform and keep the sediment from piling up under the bridge.
Can we get a copy of the Maloney and McBroom report? I guess we can ask our legislative aide or something like that.
Yeah, the town board reviewed, saw a final presentation on it and accepted it in January. The Flood Advisory Committee is working with McBroom to put the finishing touches on it. They're including a little bit more information on high-risk zones along Main Street, along the Sophus Creek, and then it will be published online at the Town of Shandaken website and also the website that CC maintains for the Shokan Stream Program, which is www.shokanstreams.org. But I'd be glad to send you a link, all of you a link to it.
I just have one other question about Aaron Bennett. Is he being paid then by the grant or by the county? And so, yeah, you might know Ken.
Sure. Aaron Bennett is an employee of Ulster County. We receive revenue that helps us in the salary.
Okay, great.
Good to know. Indeed.
So his full-time job then is with the stream management program? Interesting.
It's been really valuable having him out there. I was just in a meeting with Sylvia Rosella, town of Olive supervisor, was going on and on about what a big help he's been. So he's able to link back to the DPW, to the planning department, he's been assisting with getting a FEMA buyout, not a little bit, assisting with FEMA buyouts, and maybe able to assist in the future with that sort of thing. But then working with the town and helping them get through the update to the additional hazard plan was really critical with that. And so we're really happy to have that position.
No, I know that. I'm just interested in the arrangement.
Two years ago, we transitioned to the program where we received dollars that
I think that's, we should try to do more of that. Thank you.
If you have any other questions later, feel free to contact me.
Thank you.
That's one of our two satellite offices. It's lovely, but you should stop.
I've been told that the board handed out that stuff, so probably. So, no, I'll be short. Lee said you guys had other stuff to do, and I'm the last one, so. I'm Liz Higgins. I manage the commercial agriculture program and also the community horticulture program, which is largely the Master Gardener program for Cornell Cooperative Extension. I have, I guess, how many now? There's 5 ag program staff. We have a program assistant, and Donna Crawford is our Master Gardener and Community Horticulture staff person. So these are all full-time positions. We also subcontract for a day a week with Orange County for an educator who can provide some technical assistance to people who want to do kind of quirky things. He just held like a mushroom class, permaculture-type classes, and he helps with my beginning farmer and land access program, too. Our core program, I'm sort of dividing our program into programs that are funded with county dollars and then programs that are entirely grant funded. My ag program is actually in community horticulture is largely funded through grant dollars at this point. But one of the main programs that is funded by the county is the Eastern New York Commercial Horticulture Program. About 3 years ago, the fruit and vegetable education and extension in the region moved to a regional program. The benefits to this were to allow closer relations with Cornell faculty, so you had a team approach. It allowed the educators to specialize in areas where they had particular strengths, since these are some of our premier industries. You know, a lot of the growers really needed people who had like even higher level expertise. Teresa Rusnik, for example, who's in our county, used to have to do everything from, you know, beginning farmer and managing the Master Gardener program to really high-level greenhouse production questions. This allows her, for example, as part of that team, to really focus on vegetable production specifically. In that program would be Teresa, who covers vegetables, Dan, who covers tree fruit, and Jim O'Connell is half-time on this program, and he covers grapes and berries for the team. But he intensively works more in Ulster County because we have a grant that funds his time to be here also. The county provides $107,000 towards this team. We're the largest contributor, and we have largely because we have especially a large apple industry that needs a lot of technical assistance. But it's really, you know, from everything I hear from the team members, it's really been a really great opportunity for them to be able to step up their game. And it's also allowed them to participate in even more grant projects with Cornell faculty to respond to grower needs. An example of this, brown marmorated stink bug, if you haven't found it in your attic by now, I'm sorry about the apple. I'm sure you will find it, but it's a really significant pest of both vegetables and tree fruit in our area. They're very difficult to deal with. They've got those little hard shells, and like nothing kills them, right? They're just like little pens of the pest world. And so Teresa and Dan have been cooperating with Cornell to do traps and to do a set, you know, to really help monitor this and do research on the impact that this pest is having to growers in our region. And this is happening in the counties even across this region. But this is a really significant pest. So another core program that's funded by county dollars is the Master Gardener Program. The Master Gardener Program this year is receiving about $10,000 in county dollars, and all of the rest of the program is either program-generated income or grants. And Emily, Melanie had done that really nice sort of like economic impact of, you know, county funding and what has. You know, we have right now for this $10,000, we've got like 60 really, really, really active master gardeners. They each put in about over a three-year period at least 100 hours in order to be qualified as a master gardener volunteer. And they run like all of our programs at the community college. We do, you know, we have a xeriscape garden where they do a lot of classes for the public on xeriscape gardening, which is gardening without water. But because water actually is getting into the xeriscape garden, they then built a rain garden to help people also learn about dealing with overwet plants. We partner with CRISP, which is the Catskill Regional Invasive Species Partnership, to also do invasive species education. So people can come in from anywhere in the county, and if they've got a plant and they're concerned whether or not it's an invasive, our master gardeners will ID it for free and give them recommendations, and we do all sorts of programs for the public on invasives. And we also had a project last year, and I think we're partnering again this year with Cornell's Landscape Architecture Program in the city of Kingston to really help urban landowners manage small parcels cooperatively for the benefit of wildlife and birds, and also to try to get more diversity for pollinators too. So we did in two neighborhoods, the students in partnership with the Master Gardeners did designs for the landowners, and that were all sort of living near each other. And this year we've also offered them and all of their neighbors free native shrubs that have good wildlife and bird benefits, and also some flowers that have good pollinator benefits. So we're trying to get more concentration of these in a quarter like setting, these types of plants, to try to, even in a city like Kingston, to try to have more environmental benefits. And then the rest of the program is grant funded. Like, for example, I'm 100% grant funded. A lot of our staff are. So programs that cover livestock, farm business, beginning farmers, and land use would all be funded. We've received a large grant from the New World Foundation, and that's really allowed the ag program staff in the last few years to go from, you know, two full-time people who, you know, the tree fruit person, Mike Barchion, who some of you may have known, and Teresa, to now, you know, it's essentially an eight-person staff. We received the New World Foundation, and then we also have received grants from American Farmland Trust, from Penn State. We've had some grants from the USDA Risk Management to do pesticide safety trainings. And so in the last few weeks, we've been doing farmland transition planning, especially for women, so to help them plan around retirement or options for like transferring the farm, or for the second generation, how to work with your parents, you know, in order to have to help keep land in agriculture. So in 2015, and this is just, I don't actually have the data for Eastern New York because it covers so many counties, it can be hard to pull out. So really, these numbers here are really just for the grant-funded staff that I manage sort of in-house. So it would be for livestock, farm business, small grains. We have an educator doing small grains production, field crops. We've done 82 hours of programming. We reached 685 people at our classes last year. And we had over 1,251 one-on-one technical assistance calls. Either we went out to farms and did site visits, or they called and we emailed responses. So these don't include, if you had factored in Eastern New York, I mean, I'm sure you would see these numbers double, because I know Teresa is out with a lot of the growers, and Dan Donahue, who's our tree fruit specialist, also works very intensively with a lot of the growers in the region. So we, you know, we really take what, you know, we're a good share of the county appropriation. I mean, as you can see, we're probably about a third of the appropriation But the actual impact that we have and the dollars that we generate on top of that, more than, you know, at least we've quadrupled the county funds just with the other grants that we've received, plus all of the benefits that we have back to growers here. These are the examples of some of our projects. We're having a lot of people that want to either get into farming or access farmland, so we're working very closely with American Farmland Trust. People call up, they're looking at a parcel, they're not sure if they can farm it. They're looking to rent a parcel, and they're not really sure what a fair rental rate would be. We'll actually go out there and help them figure out what kind of infrastructure they need, whether it's a good location or not, what it would be most suitable for. And then a lot of the classes that we're offering on farmland transition and stuff we're also doing through this to try to keep, you know, really good farmland in active agricultural production. Jim O'Connell, who's part with the Eastern New York team and part with Ulster, and I are working together with Rice Farm and actually Spoonmaker to develop, we're in the Cornell farm worker program, to develop and test tools to help improve communications with non-English speaking farm workers around pruning practices. The problem is there's opportunities for miscommunication, and when you're dealing with pruning fruit, mistakes in pruning can be like multi-year problems as far as production practices. So what's really unique about this program, though, is we have a woman from the Cornell Farm Worker Program who's coming down, and we're actually getting the feedback of the farm workers in the best ways to do some of the education. So it isn't just how we think that, you know, we're not just sort of creating fact sheets and translating them and handing them over, but we're soliciting feedback from the farm workers about how they would best be able to use the information and getting their suggestions about signage or marking things that so that, you know, because they're the ones who are out in the field and have to manage their time. So those farm workers who have a lot of experience have been very valuable to us and really finding ways that they feel like they could use the information. And they're very interested, actually. So it's allowing us to extend that sort of our research-based information into a new audience in a way that we haven't been able to do before. And then finally, Justin's been very active. We have a lot of people. I mean, everybody now wants to have a brewery or a distillery, or a brewery distillery, or still brewing, or in wine. And so Justin's been working with Mark Sorrells at Cornell. A lot of farms in the area. Nick Direlli Farm has been a very active cooperator. The Farm Hub has been an active cooperator. And he's been working with Keegan Ale in Kingston and Tuttletown and a bunch of other distilleries and breweries to identify grains that grow well in our region that also are really utilized well in processing. So it's not good enough to find a variety of grain that'll grow if its performance when you're trying to use it isn't very good. So we're really looking to find those varieties of grain that actually do perform well for malting, because malting barley has been a real challenge for our area. It actually fails a lot of years because it's very sensitive to moisture and disease pressure. But also for baking, you know, bakers tend to be more picky about the kinds of grain, the hard meats and stuff. So this has been a really interesting project for us. It's an area that there's a lot of growth in, and it provides an opportunity even for vegetable growers to, the biggest issue in our area with vegetable production is really labor. Grain production is much less labor intensive and provides, perhaps especially should distilling and brewing, bakeries, should we identify really good sources of grains that are economically viable, it's a way for maybe some of us, some of the growers to manage some of their labor costs on land that might be suitable for grain production is marginal for vegetable production or as part of a rotation. So this has been a really interesting area of research for us and sort of outreach. And that's it.
Thank you.
Just a few comments. I'm really great that we had this opportunity to kind of give you a snapshot of the kinds of things that we do. We are part of Cornell University. Our job is to take the research that's done at that university and other land grants. There's one in every state. Some states have a couple because there were 1890 colleges and whatever, to take that research and bring it back to the folks who have supported those land grant institutions for their tax dollars or whatever. That's what we do. We're over 100 years old. We've been working here in Ulster County since 1913. Started off at the historic Pearson House. We called it 74 John Street because that was the address. And moved twice. This is our latest iteration of offices. We have a satellite office in Highland, which is held in conjunction with the Cornell Experiment Station through Geneva and Cornell University. And then we have another one in Phoenicia, and that's where our watershed work is done. We have a $5 million budget. A lot of that money, $2 million of that is DEP money that flows through us that we run a grant program and help distribute that money with local input into projects that Leslie was talking about. So we have a lot of really neat things. Are you here for the chicken class?
Yes.
You're in there. You're in the right place, but we had to move you. So going on tonight is another backyard chicken class, which is an overflow. The kinds of things we do. We are really a chicken. We're not a service organization. We work in conjunction with a lot of different county departments, as you know, you heard the names of them and whatever, in support of them and their efforts. We work very hard not to duplicate things, and again, we're not service oriented. So. Education oriented. If you've got any questions at all about what we do or how we do it, happy to have more detailed conversations with you. Very excited to have you here, and thank you very much, this committee, and also the County Executive's Office for the support you've given Cooperative Extension over the years.
I just have one question related to the New World Foundation, because I'm very interested in the way that they're funding a lot of things in the area. Are they expecting a certain outcome after the period of time? Is it like a 3-year?
The first grant we had with them was, I think, 3 years. That was a declining grant where we were then generating grant programs and whatever to offset that. And then they realized that their needs were greater. And I said, so we did what you asked, and now we don't have really much time to work with you anymore. So we changed that for the next go-around. And so we're just finishing up. Next year we'll be finishing up the second third-year grant.
The first grant was supposed to be 3 years. We only actually did it for 2 years.
Right.
This year is our last year of the third of the new three-year grant. So this will start this year.
And we're in talks with them already about extending. They're interested in the kinds of things that we can do. When we first started working with New World, basically what we said is, look, we're education and we're county. And we're also regional. And so we have to be able to do that. And as long as that's what you're interested in, we can tie into Cornell, we can tie into the lab, or whatever, and they were. And so that's what we've done. Some of their other grants are more specific towards different kinds of outcomes, but the kinds of things that they will work with us on are a lot of these field trials and whatever, what works here, what doesn't work here, and especially tying information into new folks who are interested in farming and don't have access to land or capital or whatever. We work very, very closely with them on that.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you. Okay, so we'll move on to the resolutions. Resolution 175, confirming the appointment of the Ulster County Historian.
Second.
Any discussion?
He's wonderful.
Okay. Just for the record. Okay, so do we have all in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Okay. Approving the Resolution 187, approving the execution of a contract amendment in excess of $50,000 entered into by the county in any time home care office from the Office of Aging.
Yes, this doesn't explain what they do on this at all. Ken?
What exactly are they doing?
These are personal care services. These are in-home services for your, depending on the level of personal care,
basic housekeeping is something we know it gets.
24 hour care.
Today.
That would be more as the Medicaid side.
Okay. Okay.
These are more basic.
The other
basic care provided to seniors for them to reason.
And do any seniors contribute to that? They don't make a contribution to that.
Just above the 80% or whatever.
Right, these are for people that are above the care for Medicaid.
Yeah.
Right. But well, some people that are above the Medicaid, if they're not that far above, they can still go on Medicaid and they have a spend down.
Right.
You have to meet a certain amount for the spend down, and once they meet the spend, you know, they meet the spend down cost. I mean, they'll have to pay. They may pay $200 a month, shall we say, depending on the income. And then they get, they'll have full Medicaid, and part of that Medicaid is having.
Once someone is eligible for Medicaid, they'll receive the services from the Department of Social Services.
Right. But in this case here, this is different. So this is for somebody that might make double the amount, shall we say?
There's a full assessment that's done. It's a assessment. The income is exactly.
So this is the full amount, these four contracts for this service from the county? I just meant there's no other contracts in the course of the year for this particular home care. You know, I guess I just never knew. I didn't know as much as I would like to know now. So instead of asking the committee, I just wondered if maybe you could visit the program with you in some way, because I'd like to know more about it.
I'd love to bring you right here. Well, you've done so many really interesting things over the last year in particular. Mm-hmm. With our home delivered meals program, mm-hmm. I think cancer is the best in the state of New York. The level of service we provide, we actually, you know, I was just telling Dave earlier, so that the clients not only receive their choice of a daily hot meal or weekly frozen delivery, they now receive a monthly pantry bag.
Right.
So they can have stock in their pantry. A lot of work. In fact, our most vulnerable seniors that are in caseload actually have a care coordinator assigned to them through our current program. I can't identify another county that's capable of providing that level of service.
Well, as a matter of fact, when Hector asked me to look at CDBG and what other places are doing that are innovative, one of them was delivery of meals in other communities that's funded in part by CDBG. So I'd be happy to share that example with you, because I think aging in place has got to be one of the most critical things we can help our community do. I think it's a big savings in general in our community to help people, and I think better for our communities to help people age in place. So.
Yeah, I agree. And if you look at the appropriations that the legislature has approved in the last 2 years, we substantially increased the $20 that are in the mix. At the moment, we have no way to
Excuse me.
So anyone that has applied for services in the next year. Spent a lot of time. Jimmy, you were here. The vendor we've used for years has decided to change their business model. And again, we took that as an opportunity to revisit the whole program and get some set an example. We've had a lot of counties contacting us to kind of look at how we structure the new program and kind of learn from the problem.
Yeah, they basically, if you didn't realize, what ended up happening was it was almost the last minute they said, oh, by the way, we don't want to deliver meals for you anymore. I was sort of like, oh. So I give Ken Cornell a great deal of credit. He really worked really hard to make sure that this was done and done right. Well, that was easy. That was easy. You did the work.
Yeah, but again, if we're looking at this, aging in place is one that we look at our, the last census on senior population is going to be part of the church. It's part about having an office for how to provide service in the county besides Rhode Island.
And it's going to continue.
Well, it's going to grow, right, because of the age
Since these three are the same, I'd make a motion to move 187, 188, and 189 together.
Second.
And 190, that's correct. Okay. And 190.
So, all in favor of the block? Aye.
Aye.
Okay. Yeah, that'd be awesome. Thank you.
Yes. Yeah, that'd be nice.
All right. So, that brings us to Resolution 190, approving the execution of a contract amendment to access the picture.
Yeah, we added that one.
We added that one.
That was another one part of the bulk, 187 through 190.
All right. So Resolution 248, setting a public hearing on proposed local law number 6 of 2016, a local law amending local law number 3 of 2012, a local law to provide for an exemption for real property taxes for real property owned by veterans who rendered military service to the United States during the Cold War, to be held on Tuesday, May 10th, 2016 at
16 p.m. Nothing on here, Ken, that tells me what their time frame is that you're using for the Cold War.
Sure, these are state prices.
No, I mean, what is the time? In other words,
like what years?
What years are they using for the Cold War? I mean, what do they
it's
use?
49 to 89.
So they use 49 to 89.
Pretty much. I mean, it wasn't right after World War II, and it ended when the wall came down, although a little later, really. Yeah.
Yeah. Essentially, the Cold War exemption is a 15% exemption up to $45,000. With this law, currently it's $36,000.
And the state increased it basically.
The state provided the ability for
the right, right.
I think we're probably the first one in the state that's done it. What happened is when the state passed the authority for this local option last year, there's a technical problem with the law, so they just corrected it. It's Chapter 22 of 16, the governor signed it on Friday. So we anticipated it coming, so we advanced a local law for the state to different change.
Okay, we just need someone to move it and second it.
I'll move it.
We estimate the fiscal impact that it's not an increase in taxes that the county levies, but it's shift around the burden of the residents of the county. It's about 2 cents per $100,000.
Thank you. Any other discussion? It turns out it's 47 to 91.
Aye. Is that what they're using? How much
okay,
is very curious is what they use for them.
Resolution 249, setting a public hearing on proposed local law number 7 of 2016, a local law amending local law number 4 of 2012, to increase the maximum allowable real property tax exemption pursuant to section 458A of the real property tax law entitled Veterans Alternative Exemption, to be held on Tuesday, May 10th at 6:20 p.m. So, any other discussion?
Yes,
all right, call the vote. All in favor?
Aye.
Okay, is there any new business? No? Okay, do we have a motion to adjourn?
No.
Second in favor? Thank you, everyone.
Thank you. Thank you for hosting me.
Thank you. What are you doing with all that stuff?
That's what they're using.
That's what they're using. Yeah, I don't know what. That's right. Okay.
That's what I was curious.
I think of it starting actually more or less the Korean War and not really before. Like they think
World War II. Actually, some people will say it's right.
Well, some people will say, right, when some will say it was. Yeah, well, some people will say that it broke down a little later, but. Yeah.